Chapter 6 Collapse. The Fall of Empires. In AD 100, there were two major empires in the world, about equal in territorial extent and population. Between them, they encompassed more than one half of the world's population. We discussed one of them, the Han Dynasty, in Chapter 4. That was the empire that locked in Confucianism as the primary Chinese ideology for over 2,000 years. The other was the Roman Empire, which had a very different fate. If you had been the Roman Emperor in AD 100, you would have regarded yourself as ruling the pinnacle of technological, legal, and economic advancement. You would have had much to support your view. Your empire enjoyed the benefits of central heating and double glazing, which insulated your public baths. You used concrete, which was in some ways more durable than the concrete we use today. You built mighty structures, such as the Colosseum, which could seat more than 50,000 people, and the Circus Maximus, a chariot racing stadium that could seat 150,000. You controlled an area larger than today's European Union, despite having no modern means of travel, such as railways or airplanes, or modern communication technology. Your economy was complex and sophisticated, with a high degree of division of labor, a banking system, and international trade across continents. Traders roamed your empire selling goods and spreading knowledge. There was even a historically unusual middle class of around 10% of the population and upward social mobility, as evidenced by satires about the follies of the new rich. Even peasants under your rule had access to useful goods like high-quality pottery and tiled roofs. The growth of the Roman Empire's prosperity is reflected in the population growth of Rome, the first city ever to reach 1 million residents. In the Roman Republic, the price of Rome's growth was the blood of its citizens and neighbours. Between 410 BC and 101 BC, Rome was at war more than 90% of the time. After the formation of the Roman Empire in 27 BC, though, Rome experienced 2 centuries of growth in both population and living standards. Rome was strong and stable. At the time, it would have seemed like the city's flourishing, driven by advances in technology and governance, would continue long into the future. This is not what happened. In the 5th century, the city of Rome was sacked twice by marauding Germanic tribes, in AD 410 by the Visigoths and in AD 455 by the Vandals. On learning of the AD 410 sack of Rome, St. Jerome commented, "The brightest light of the whole world is extinguished. Indeed, the head has been cut from the Roman Empire. To put it more truthfully, the whole world has died with one city." Who would have believed that Rome, which was built up from victories over the whole world, would fall, so that it would be both the mother and the tomb to all peoples? Although Rome was no longer the seat of imperial power in the Western Roman Empire at that time, the decline of the city of Rome in the 5th century vividly symbolized how weak the Western Roman Empire had become. A few decades later, the whole Western Roman Empire collapsed. Rome's population dwindled to only 30,000 people, stayed at a similar level for centuries, and only surpassed its peak population again 1,400 years later in the 1930s. In fact, it wasn't until the early 19th century that any European city surpassed the population of Rome at its ancient peak. Why then did the Western Roman Empire fall? A review from 1984 found that historians had suggested no fewer than 210 distinct causes for the fall of the Western Roman Empire. Many modern historians agree on the basic narrative of Roman decline: flawed institutions, domestic power struggles over political position and surplus extraction, corruption and economic weaknesses, pressure from external invaders, and increasing detrimental impact of plagues and climate change. Because of the difficulty of managing a giant empire with pre-modern technology and communication, it is not surprising that the Roman Empire eventually crumbled, and it is more pertinent to ask why it survived for so long. Indeed, the average lifespan of a civilization is only around 340 years. For local civilizations, collapse is the rule, not the exception. In the last chapter, I discuss the risk of human extinction, which is one way that civilization could come to an end. But disasters that kill everyone are very extreme. Civilizational collapse and global catastrophes that fall short of killing everyone are arguably much more likely. Could the world today suffer the same fate as the Roman Empire? I'll use the term civilizational collapse to refer to an event in which society loses the ability to create most industrial and post-industrial technology. If there's a good chance that such a collapse would be permanent, then the risk of civilizational collapse could be of even greater long-term importance than the risk of extinction. So let's ask, how likely is it that some non-extinction catastrophe could cause civilization to collapse? And if it did, how likely would recovery be? The historical resilience of global civilization. The historical evidence suggests that human civilization has been surprisingly resilient after catastrophe. The first thing to bear in mind is just how different a global and permanent collapse of civilization would be from historical civilizational collapses. The fall of the Western Roman Empire is a particularly dramatic historical example of civilizational collapse. But even though Europe's mightiest empire fell, Europe was not completely depopulated. Rather, Roman rule was supplanted by the Visigoths, Vandals, Ostrogoths, Franks, Britons, and Saxons. Still, technological sophistication and living standards did decline precipitously after the fall of Rome. Britain was an extreme case. In the 5th century, the use of writing vanished, and all of the Romans' buildings' crafts disappeared. Stone, brick, and tiled buildings gave way to wood and thatch. But this technological and cultural decline was not permanent. It was out of the ashes of the Western Roman Empire, centuries later, that the Renaissance, the Scientific Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, and the Enlightenment were born. Indeed, in the accounts of several leading economic historians, the comparative political fragmentation of Europe after the fall of Rome partly explains why the scientific and industrial revolutions occurred there rather than in China. Moreover, all historical civilizational collapses to date have been local. When the Western Roman Empire collapsed, some of the other major civilizations of the time, such as the northern and southern dynasties in China, the Aksumite Empire in Ethiopia, the Three Kingdoms of Korea, Teotihuacan in Mexico, the Maya civilization in Central America, the Sasanian dynasty in modern-day Iran, and the Gupta Empire in India, continued much as before, and many of them knew nothing of the Roman Empire in the first place. Despite losing its Western partner, the Eastern Roman Empire, or Byzantium, survived for another 1,000 years. Indeed, even huge crises have failed to knock global civilization off course. Over the last 60 years, the period for which we have the best data, world GDP has only shrunk in a single year a handful of times, and it has always completely rebounded within a couple of years. It is not even clear whether the population declined during the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918, in which 17 million to 100 million people died. Even though World War II was the deadliest war in history by the number of casualties, it did not cause the global population to decline. The last time global population even came close to declining over the period of decades was during what some historians refer to as the General Crisis. This was a period over the 17th century when almost everything was going wrong. Major wars in Europe, China, and India, including the 30 Years' War and the collapse of the Ming Dynasty, the widespread deaths of indigenous Americans from European colonialism, the rise of the transatlantic slave trade, and what's called the Little Ice Age, where temperatures in Europe cooled, leading to widespread famine. The global population loss may have been large. In the first half of the 17th century, according to some estimates, the Chinese population plummeted by around 40%, while Germany and parts of France lost 20% to 45% of their populations. Yet despite these crises, by AD 1700, the world population was larger than before the general crisis. A vivid illustration of historical societal resilience comes from the Black Death, a pandemic of the bubonic plague in the 14th century that spread across the Middle East and Europe. The Black Death was mainly spread by infected fleas transported across the world by rats on trade ships, fleeing the Mongol invasion of Crimea. It may have been the deadliest natural catastrophe in history when measured as a percentage of world population lost. Somewhere between one quarter and one half of all Europeans died, and the Middle East was also terribly affected. All in all, around one tenth of the global population lost their lives. Those who died did so in utter misery. If any natural event would have brought about the collapse of civilization, we would have expected this to be it. But despite the enormous loss of human lives and intense suffering that the Black Death caused, it did little to negatively impact longer-term European economic and technological development. European population size returned to its pre-pandemic levels two centuries later. European colonial expansion continued, and the Industrial Revolution occurred just four centuries later. Other examples of remarkable societal resilience are more recent. We can consider, for example, the atomic bombing of the Japanese city of Hiroshima in 1945. The bomb the United States dropped was 1,500 times more powerful than any previously used. The fireball at the hypocenter of the blast reached several thousand degrees Celsius within 1/10,000th of a second before igniting all flammable material within 1.5 miles. 90% of the city's buildings were at least partially incinerated or reduced to rubble. Initial estimates suggested that 70,000 died because of the bombing before the end of 1945, while more recent estimates put the figure at 140,000. The heat from the blast was so ferocious that steps, pavements, and walls were brightened, and the people incinerated in the blast left darkened shadows. One person, thought to be a woman named Mitsuno Ochi, left a shadow on the steps of the Bank of Japan, now preserved at the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum, in an exhibit known as The Human Shadow of Death. Before learning about Hiroshima's subsequent history, I would have thought that, even today, it would be a nuclear wasteland, consisting of little more than smoking ruins, Mitsuno Ochi's shadow on a citywide scale. But nothing could be further from the truth. Despite the enormous loss of life and destruction of infrastructure, power was restored to some areas within a day, to 30% of homes within 2 weeks, and to all homes not destroyed by the blast within 4 months. There was a limited rail service running the day after the attack. There was a streetcar service running within 3 days. Water pumps were working again within 4 days, and telecommunications were restored in some areas within a month. The Bank of Japan, just 380 meters from the hypocenter of the blast, reopened within just 2 days. The population of Hiroshima returned to its pre-destruction level within a decade. Today, it is a thriving modern city of 1.2 million people. The remarkable recovery from such unfathomable destruction is a testament to the resilience of the people of Hiroshima and the surrounding towns. But Hiroshima wasn't unique. While reconstruction was slower in Nagasaki after it was bombed, the story is fundamentally similar. Nagasaki surpassed its former population in under a decade and is now a prosperous city. And a broader study on the bombing of Japanese cities during World War II suggests that this rally was widespread. Dozens of Japanese cities had at least half their buildings burned to the ground. But these cities soon returned to their previous size, economic output, and even share of particular industries. A similar study of Vietnamese cities after the Vietnam War reached much the same conclusion. The Vietnam War involved the most intense aerial bombing in history. The US Air Force dropped on Vietnam 3 times the weight of bombs it used in World War II. But remarkably, the authors of the study found no impacts of this bombing on local poverty rates, consumption levels, infrastructure, literacy rates, or population density 25 years after the end of the war. Sometimes, people claim that because the modern world is so complex and interreliant, it is therefore fragile, and if one strut is lost, the entire structure will fall in a domino effect. But this idea neglects people's astonishing grit, adaptability, and ingenuity in the face of adversity. This adaptability can be seen even when a disaster-struck area is cut off from the rest of the world and cannot receive assistance from elsewhere. For example, when Serbian armed forces laid siege to the city of Gorazde, Bosnia, between 1992 and 1995, the city lost much of its physical infrastructure and was cut off from the national power grid. But residents of Gorazde jury-rigged hydroelectric generators using scavenged alternators to meet basic power needs. In an even more extreme case, after the fall of the Soviet Union, which had been the sole supplier of Cuba's agricultural equipment and supplies, Cuba lost all access to fossil fuels, fertilizers, pesticides, and agricultural machinery, and depleted its stores within a few years. In response, Cuba implemented an emergency program to breed 400,000 oxen to replace its industrial machinery, allowing it to avoid widespread famine. Would we recover from extreme catastrophes? Perhaps, though, the historical track record is a misleading guide to our resilience to future catastrophes. After all, we have no historical examples of global catastrophes killing more than 20% of the world population. But now, with nuclear weapons, we have the capacity to kill a much greater fraction of the population. Advanced bioweapons will make this capacity even greater. If there were a catastrophe of unprecedented severity, would society collapse? And if it did collapse, would it ever recover? I'll look at these questions by exploring the potential impact of an all-out nuclear war, though my analysis also applies to other catastrophes, including those involving biological weapons. The bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki saw the use of weapons that were more than 1,500 times more powerful than the most powerful explosives of the time. But compared to the nuclear arsenals we have today, their destructive power was tiny. The bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were atomic, relying on the fission of uranium or plutonium. In contrast, the first H-bomb, which utilized the energy released from the fusion of hydrogen isotopes into helium, was developed in 1952 and was 500 times more powerful. The largest bomb tested had an explosive yield of 50 million tons, over 3,000 times that of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. In parallel, the global stockpile of nuclear weapons rose many thousandfold, from 2 in 1945 to just over 40,000 in 1967. The overall destructive power of explosive weapons therefore increased enormously over the course of just two decades, with the vast majority of those weapons built by the United States and the Soviet Union. It would be a mistake to infer that, because an all-out nuclear war never occurred, it was very unlikely to have occurred. Indeed, there were several close calls. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, John F. Kennedy put the chance of an all-out nuclear war at somewhere between 1 in 3 and even. In 1979, US command centers detected a large number of incoming nuclear missiles, causing them to begin preparing for their own counterstrike. But when senior commanders checked the raw data to confirm the strike, they saw no evidence of incoming missiles. Upon further investigation, they realized a training tape designed to simulate a Soviet nuclear strike had been accidentally playing on the command center screens. Just 4 years later, during a period of heightened tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union, a similar false alarm took place in a Soviet command center after a Soviet early warning system detected 5 incoming nuclear missiles. The officer on duty, Stanislav Petrov, was skeptical that a US first strike would involve just 5 nuclear missiles, and he couldn't find evidence of the missiles' vapor trails. Based on this alone, he reasoned that the warning system must have been mistaken and correctly reported the warning as a false alarm. If he had not, Soviet protocol was to launch a counterstrike, though it is unclear whether those higher in command would have believed that it was not a false alarm. Thankfully, total US and Russian stockpiles have fallen by a factor of 7 since their peak in 1986. But they are still very high, with 9,500 nuclear warheads remaining. And compared to total defense budgets, the cost to manufacture new nuclear warheads is very small. If there were a reignition of serious military tensions between the United States and Russia, or new military tensions between other nuclear powers like the United States and China, or India and Pakistan, nuclear arsenals could grow significantly. An all-out nuclear war would potentially kill a much larger percentage of the world than any catastrophe we have seen. The direct death toll alone would be measured in the tens to hundreds of millions. Even worse, some modelling suggests that such a war could result in a nuclear winter. If soot from the burning cities were lofted high enough to reach the stratosphere, then global average temperatures would drop by 8 degrees Celsius, returning to normal only over the course of 10 to 20 years. This would make it impossible to grow food across much of the northern hemisphere for several years, though agriculture would still be feasible across much of the tropics and the southern hemisphere, albeit hampered by reduced rainfall in many places. Some argue that this could lead to widespread famine, potentially putting billions at risk of starvation. For concreteness, let's consider what I would regard as an absolute worst-case nuclear scenario, in which 99% of the world population dies in the aftermath of an all-out war, leaving a global population of around 80 million. This is perhaps possible if weapons stockpiles greatly expand and weapons become much more powerful, or if other weapons, such as bioweapons, are also used. Using my definition of civilizational collapse as an event in which society loses the ability to create most industrial and post-industrial technology, we can now try to answer the first question. If 99% of the population died, would civilization collapse? Up until recently, this question had only very limited investigation, so I commissioned a report on the topic from Luisa Rodriguez, a researcher for Rethink Priorities, who subsequently came to join my team. Luisa does not fit the typical stereotype of a prepper, someone who worries about and prepares for societal catastrophe. The daughter of a socialist who fled El Salvador and gained asylum in the United States, for most of her life she worked on pretty typical issues for a socially conscious member of the left. As a teenager, she wanted to be a Peace Corps volunteer like her grandparents, and during university, she oscillated between pursuing a career as an infectious disease doctor and one in international development nonprofits. Now she possesses a small stash of survivalist tools, heirloom seeds, because many of the plants grown on modern farms are hybrids that do not guarantee that desirable traits will be passed on to the next generation. A flint-based lighter, because making fire is difficult, and a hand crank emergency generator. On a date night with her partner, they created a plan for what to do if an apocalypse occurred, including where to meet if all communications infrastructure was down. I found this strangely romantic. For all this, Luisa is fairly optimistic about the robustness of civilization in the face of catastrophe. I share this qualified optimism. Society probably would not collapse. But it is difficult to be completely sure, and when the stakes are so high, the risk of non-recovery should be taken very seriously. One set of reasons for optimism comes from the examples of post-catastrophe societies we've just discussed, such as Europe after the Black Death, Hiroshima, and Cuba. Even in the face of enormous local catastrophes, society recovered remarkably quickly. There are also specific reasons to think that civilization would not collapse if 99% of people died. Much of the physical infrastructure, like buildings, tools, and machines, would be preserved and could be used after the catastrophe. Similarly, most knowledge would be preserved in the minds of those still alive, in digital storage, and in libraries. There are 2.6 million libraries in the world, with hundreds of thousands in countries without either nuclear weapons or alliances with countries with nuclear weapons. Critical skill sets would still remain. Even if a catastrophe killed 99% of people, the chance that among the survivors there would be fewer than 100 aeroplane engineers, nuclear power plant workers, organic chemists, or telecommunications engineers is close to zero. 2 billion people today work in agriculture, with a sizable fraction working in smallholder subsistence farms, so it is exceptionally unlikely that we would lose all knowledge of agriculture. Finally, any large-scale catastrophe would be quite diverse in its impacts. Because all countries with nuclear weapons are in the northern hemisphere, the impacts of a nuclear winter would be more limited in the southern hemisphere, and because oceans retain heat, coastal areas would be much less affected. For coastal South America or Australia, a nuclear winter would result in a summer about 5 degrees cooler than usual, which would be bad but manageable. Similarly, if bioweapons were used, some island nations that were not involved in the conflict might be better able than other countries to defend against them by closing their borders. Often, when worst-case disasters are modelled, New Zealand tends to come out relatively unscathed, which is why so many ultra-rich preppers buy property there. So when we imagine a world in which 99% of people have died, we should not imagine this as being uniform across the world. Rather, some countries would be devastated and some comparatively unaffected. This makes the chance of global recovery higher. Those countries, perhaps Australia and New Zealand, that would not be directly affected would have their population, infrastructure, knowledge base, and political and civil institutions intact. And they could be self-sufficient. Australia and New Zealand already grow several times the amount of food required to sustain their own population. Between them, they have ample fossil fuel reserves. Even in the wake of such an unprecedented disaster, civilization would continue. As a sanity check on this argument, we could think about the last time that the world population was at 80 million people, which was very roughly in 2500 BC. At this time, although global civilization was much less technologically sophisticated than today, it was not on the brink of collapse. And on balance, I think a post-catastrophe world would be better off than the world in 2500 BC because of the knowledge, physical capital, and institutions we have developed over the last 4,500 years. Now let's turn to the second question. Suppose that there were some catastrophe that resulted in the complete collapse of global civilization, and we could rely only on pre-industrial technology. Perhaps the considerations I've just given are mistaken in some way, and a war that killed 99% of people really would be sufficient for global civilizational collapse. Or perhaps some other, even larger catastrophe occurred, killing 99.999% of the world population, leaving only tens of thousands of people. If this happened, would we lose agriculture? And if we did, would we ever get it back? Or would we remain in hunter-gatherer or farming societies for millions of years, until some natural disaster, like an asteroid strike, killed us off? In part for the reasons I've just given, it is difficult to see why agriculture would stop after the collapse. If the world population shrank to 80 million, it is extremely likely that enough survivors would have knowledge of agriculture. The last time the world population was 80 million, in 2500 BC, we were already well into the agricultural revolution. Even if the global population fell to tens of thousands, it is still likely that some of the survivors would have knowledge of agriculture. Moreover, we would be in a much better position to maintain agriculture relative to people in 2500 BC. It took thousands of years for us to domesticate wild plants to make them better suited to farming, slowly and mainly inadvertently, selecting those plants that bore the highest yields. The difference between modern domesticated plants and their wild ancestors is truly extraordinary. For example, the maize we eat today is around 10 times larger than its wild ancestor, teosinte. Likewise, the wild ancestor of watermelon was half the size, had pale white flesh, and was much less sweet than modern watermelons, while the wild ancestor of the modern tomato was only slightly larger than a pea. Access to these domesticated plants would leave us in a much better place than early agriculturalists. This does not mean that agricultural yields would immediately be as high as they are today. High modern yields depend in large part on industrial products such as synthetic fertilizer, insecticides, and pesticides. Without these, many crops would be lost to weeds and pests. In addition, many domesticated plants are hybrids. They are produced by crossing two inbred strains to produce one high-yielding strain. Hybrid crops lose their desirable properties over the generations. If there were a break in agriculture, some important varieties of some of our staple crops, in particular maize and to a lesser extent rice, would probably be lost. However, many strains of our staple crops, including most strains of wheat and soybeans and many strains of rice, are not hybrids, so they would likely survive. Another key factor would be that, depending on the catastrophe, the long-term climatic conditions that seem to be necessary for agriculture would still be in place. Agriculture was developed at least 10 times across history, at different times and in different places. Archaeobotanists have found evidence that societies in Mesopotamia domesticated wheat, barley, rye, and figs between 11,000 BC and 8,000 BC. People in South and Central America independently domesticated squash at around the same time, in 8,000 BC. 3,000 years later, Papua New Guinea domesticated yams, bananas, and taro. This happened again and again, among societies that never crossed paths, with entirely different crops, thousands of years apart. This happened as we transitioned out of the last ice age into the warmer period that we still live in today, known as the Holocene. The reason the Holocene has been conducive to agriculture is that it is warm, so frost does not destroy the growing season. It has higher carbon dioxide levels, which is good for crop yields, and it is climatically stable. If there were a collapse, we would, due to climate change, probably live in an environment 1 to 3 degrees warmer than today's. But this seems unlikely to make a major difference. Generally, it is cold and low carbon dioxide environments that make global agriculture near impossible, not warm and high carbon dioxide environments. So it seems very likely that agriculture would survive a catastrophe or would be quickly redeveloped, even if the total human population dropped to as few as tens of thousands of people. So, assuming that agriculture survived, would we reindustrialize? Unlike the development of agriculture, the Industrial Revolution happened only once. Perhaps the conditions that gave rise to it were therefore highly contingent. However, there are a few reasons for thinking that industrialization is probably not a bottleneck either. First, it took only around 13,000 years for the Industrial Revolution to occur after the very first development of agriculture. If industrialization were an incredibly unlikely event, we would expect it to have taken much longer. Of course, 13,000 years is a long time from the perspective of a single human life, but is a short time from the perspective of a species. Given the typical lifespans of other mammals or hominins, even after the major catastrophe, we would still have many hundreds of thousands of years ahead of us. The second reason for thinking that we'd reindustrialize after civilizational collapse is that the generations following a global catastrophe would in some ways have a serious head start over our predecessors. Some stone and concrete buildings would last hundreds of years. While most tools and machines would degrade within a few decades, some would be preserved in modern buildings and would be functional. Even if only a tiny fraction of tools and machines survived, this would ensure that the post-collapse survivors would know that such technology was possible, and they could reverse engineer some of the tools and machines that they found. Knowledge of industrial technology would be preserved in libraries, as would knowledge of politics and economics, which would allow embryonic states to copy successful policies. Indeed, there is evidence that industrialization happens fairly quickly on historical timescales, once the knowledge of how to industrialize is there. Once Britain industrialized, other European countries and Western offshoots like the United States quickly followed suit. It took less than 200 years for most of the rest of the world to do the same. This suggests that the path to rapid industrialization is generally attainable for agricultural societies once the knowledge is there. A final reason for thinking we'd reindustrialize is that there would be strong incentives for post-collapse societies to do so, such as improving living standards or gaining power over local competitors. Climate change. So far, I have looked at catastrophe as a result of war or accidental release of engineered pathogens. But what about climate change? Could it cause global civilization to collapse? One cause for optimism is that we are making real progress on climate change. Recent years have given us more cause for hope than any other point in my lifetime. The International Energy Agency predicts that global coal use peaked in 2014 and is now in structural decline. The main reason for the decline in coal use to date is competition from cheap natural gas. But a more fundamental future shift is now underway. This is in significant part due to environmental activism, which has changed the climate prognosis in two ways. First, thanks in part to youth activism, attention towards climate change has increased significantly, and several key players have made ambitious climate pledges, most notably China, which plans to reach zero emissions by 2060, and the European Union, which is aiming for 2050, and efforts are increasing at the state level in the United States. Second, there has also been huge progress on key low-carbon energy technologies, solar, wind, and batteries. Thanks to long-standing policy support from environmentally motivated governments, the cost of solar panels has fallen by a factor of 250 since 1976, while the cost of lithium-ion batteries has fallen by a factor of 41 since 1991. Even though solar and wind supply only around 3% of energy today, if the exponential cost declines continue, in 20 years, they will supply a substantial fraction of global energy. Similarly, in the next few years, the total cost of ownership for electric cars, including purchase, fuel and maintenance cost, is projected to drop below that of petrol and diesel cars. However, we shouldn't get complacent. There is a substantial chance that our decarbonisation efforts will get stuck. First, limited progress on decarbonisation is exacerbated by the risk of a breakdown in international coordination, which could happen because of rising military tensions between the major economies in the world, which I discussed in Chapter 5. Decarbonisation is a truly global problem. Even if most regions stop emitting, emissions could continue for a long time if one region decides not to cooperate. Second, the risk of prolonged technological stagnation, which I discuss in the next chapter, would increase the risk that we do not develop the technology needed to fully decarbonise. These are not outlandish risks. I would put both risks at around 1 in 3. For the purposes of assessing civilizational collapse, let's ask about the low probability but worst case climate scenario, in which we ultimately burn through all recoverable fossil fuels. In higher end estimates, these amount to 3 trillion tons of carbon, so if our emissions remain at current levels, this would take about 300 years. If we did so, there would most likely be around 7 degrees of warming relative to the pre-industrial period, and a 1 in 6 chance of 9.5 degrees of warming. The effect of such extreme climate change is difficult to predict. We just do not know what the world would be like if it were more than 7 degrees warmer. Most research has focused on the impact of less than 5 degrees. Warming of 7 to 10 degrees would do enormous harm to countries in the tropics, with many poor agrarian countries being hit by severe heat stress and drought. Since these countries have contributed the least to climate change, this would be a colossal injustice. But it's hard to see how even this could lead directly to civilizational collapse. For example, one pressing concern about climate change is the effect it might have on agriculture. Although climate change would be bad for agriculture in the tropics, there is scope for adaptation. Temperate regions would not be as badly damaged, and frozen land would be freed up at higher latitudes. There is a similar picture for heat stress. Outdoor labour would become increasingly difficult in the tropics because of heat stress, which would be disastrous for hotter and poorer countries with limited adaptive capacity. But richer countries would be able to adapt, and temperate regions would emerge relatively unscathed. What about feedback loops, where some amount of warming leads to further warming? Two possibilities that have been raised are moist greenhouse and runaway greenhouse effects. In both scenarios, temperatures become so hot that the oceans are lost to space, as has occurred on Venus. But the existing models suggest that it is not possible to trigger a runaway greenhouse on Earth by burning fossil fuels. It also seems unlikely that we could trigger a moist greenhouse. But if carbon dioxide did cause a transition to a moist greenhouse state, carbon dioxide concentrations would naturally decline over hundreds of thousands of years, well before the Earth's water would be lost to space. There are other possible feedback effects that look more concerning. In what is probably the most alarming climate science paper in recent years, one model found that once carbon dioxide concentrations reach around 1,300 parts per million, stratocumulus clouds will burn off, and there will be 8 degrees of warming over the course of years, on top of the 6 to 7 degrees we will already have lived through. If we burn 3 trillion tons of carbon, atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations would reach around 1,600 parts per million. So this threshold is within reach. This research is controversial, and scientists are divided on how plausible it is. Unfortunately, it is just difficult to know how great the risk of this kind of feedback is, because carbon dioxide concentrations have not been greater than 1,300 parts per million for at least tens of millions of years. But even a low probability that there could be feedback effects of this sort should greatly concern us. It is hard to know what the impact of 8 degrees of warming over the few years would be, and this question has not been researched by the scientific community. Climatic instability is generally bad for agriculture, although my best guess is that global agriculture would still be possible, even during this extreme transition. Even with 15 degrees of warming, the heat would not pass lethal limits for crops in most regions. But it is hard to know exactly what would happen, because such a change would be so extreme and so unprecedented. Possible non-linear tipping points like this are, in my view, the greatest threat that climate change poses to our long-term future. even if climate change does not drastically increase the risk of civilizational collapse, it might well make it harder to recover from collapse caused by some other event, like a nuclear or biological war. For the reasons I've just given, it seems that agriculture would still be possible even if there were high levels of warming. But it would mean that industrial civilization would have to re-emerge in a warmer world than we faced historically, which should increase our uncertainty about our prospects for recovery. Importantly, climate change lasts for a very long time. Temperatures would be similar after 10,000 years, and would only return to normal after hundreds of thousands of years. The sheer length of time before temperatures would return to current levels is long enough that, if climate change does delay recovery, almost all machines, tools, and buildings will have degraded. Almost all books in libraries will have decayed, and knowledge passed down from one generation to another may have progressively gotten corrupted. Fossil fuel depletion. Burning fossil fuels produces a warmer world, which may make civilizational recovery more difficult. But it also might make civilizational recovery more difficult simply by using up a non-renewable resource that, historically, seemed to be a critical fuel for industrialization. Our pre-industrial ancestors primarily relied on animal and human muscle, and on the burning of biomass such as wood or crops. This all changed at the start of the Industrial Revolution, which marked the beginning of centuries of almost unchecked fossil fuel burning. On the path to industrialization and out of poverty, countries begin by burning prodigious amounts of fossil fuels, usually, though not always, starting with coal and then shifting to oil and gas. Since, historically, the use of fossil fuels is almost an iron law of industrialization, it is plausible that the depletion of fossil fuels could hobble our attempts to recover from collapse. Although countries have so far almost always industrialized with fossil fuels, would that have to be true in a post-collapse world? If we have run out of coal, oil, and gas, why could we not have a green industrial revolution instead? This question has received relatively little attention, and I am only aware of one sophisticated discussion of it by Lewis Dartnell, who has spent the last few years researching how we might bounce back from catastrophe. If civilization collapsed, we might be able to get some electricity out of some of the remaining solar and wind farms. However, this would not last long. Solar panels and wind turbines degrade over the course of a few decades. It would be fiendishly difficult to create them from scratch once advanced international supply chains, such as the silicon purification factories necessary for solar panels, have been destroyed. Solar and wind also could not provide the high temperature heat that is necessary for several crucial industries, such as cement, steel, brick, and glass. In a post-collapse world, it would be very difficult to mine and transport nuclear fuel and to power up, run, and maintain technologically complex nuclear power stations. So nuclear-powered reindustrialization seems unlikely. An alternative fuel is charcoal. Charcoal is wood that has been pyrolyzed, heated without oxygen in order to remove water. It has roughly the same energy density of coal, can substitute for it, and is renewable. Brazil's steel industry, which is the ninth largest in the world, relies on charcoal to produce high-temperature heat. So we know that charcoal can power some advanced industries. The problem is that it's not clear whether we would be able to redevelop the efficient steam turbines and internal combustion engines needed to harness the energy from charcoal. In the Industrial Revolution, steam turbines were first used to pump out coal mines to extract more coal. As Lewis Dartnell says, steam engines were themselves employed at machine shops to construct yet more steam engines. It was only once steam engines were being built and operated that subsequent engineers were able to devise ways to increase their efficiency and shrink fuel demands. They found ways to reduce their size and weight, adapting them for applications in transport or factory machinery. In other words, there was a positive feedback loop at the very core of the Industrial Revolution. The production of coal, iron, and steam engines were all mutually supportive. It took a lot of easily accessible energy to develop the technologies required for the Industrial Revolution. To do the same again, we would need an enormous amount of wood, which would require a lot of land. This would compete with agriculture, which would be straining to feed a growing population. After assessing the prospects of a post-collapse recovery, Lewis Dartnell concluded that an industrial revolution without coal would be, at a minimum, very difficult. This consideration could be of major importance. If a catastrophe that falls short of killing us all, but causes us to lose industrial technology, is many times as likely as a catastrophe that causes human extinction, and if the depletion of easily accessible fossil fuels makes recovery from such catastrophe many percentage points less likely, then the depletion of fossil fuels could contribute a similar amount to the risk of the end of civilization as the risk of human extinction. If fossil fuels are potentially so important to the industrialization, we should ask, how much do we have left? There are about 12 trillion tons of carbon remaining in fossil fuel resources, of which 93% is coal. However, only a fraction of the fossil fuels are ultimately recoverable, and a much smaller fraction are easy to access. Data on global surface coal reserves are surprisingly limited, but one study from 2010 found that there are 200 billion tons of carbon remaining in surface coal. Easy-to-access coal would be especially important in a post-collapse world, in which we have regressed to pre-industrial technology. Some surface coal can be accessed with minimal digging and can be recovered using technology as simple as a shovel. Western Europe has already burned through almost all its easy-to-access coal. Most easy-to-access coal is now in China, the United States, India, Russia, and Australia. The North Antelope Rochelle coal mine in the United States, the largest coal mine in the world, contains 900 million tons of carbon in easy-to-access, recoverable coal. This single mine alone could fuel the first few decades of the industrialization. The amount of surface coal remaining worldwide would be enough to provide all of the energy we used between 1800 and 1980. However, these resources may not be around forever. If surface coal production stays constant, recoverable surface coal will last for more than 300 years in the United States, for more than 200 years in Russia and China, and for 50 to 100 years in India and Australia. At present, demand for coal is falling globally, and environmental regulations are being strengthened, so surface coal will probably last longer than this. But from a long-term point of view, we need to take these sorts of timescales seriously. The more we deplete these resources, the more we imperil our chances of reindustrialization. How likely is it that we will burn through these reserves? I see three ways this could happen. First, civilizational collapse would mean that, in the course of returning to modern levels of technology, we would probably burn through almost all remaining easy-to-access fossil fuels. Even if we have enough reserves to recover from civilizational collapse once, we wouldn't have enough if civilization collapsed a second time. This might not be as unlikely as it seems. If civilization has collapsed once, that suggests that civilizational collapse is not extremely unlikely, and it might well happen again. Second, we might fail on the last mile of decarbonization, eliminating the hardest-to-replace quarter of emissions, such as the use of coal to provide high-temperature heat in the cement and steel industries. To wholly do away with fossil fuels, we'll need a suitable combination of cheap, controllable, low-carbon power and cheap, zero-carbon fuels such as hydrogen. While innovative ways to improve these capabilities have been proposed, it is unclear whether we will get there. Worse, solving decarbonization through the long mix of technologies might backfire. The final way we might continue to burn a lot of fossil fuels is if we make extensive use of carbon capture and storage. Carbon capture and storage involves capturing carbon at point sources such as power plants and then burying it underground. Carbon can also be captured from the ambient air in a process known as negative emissions. Carbon capture would remove a large fraction of the environmental costs of fossil fuels, though the terrible air pollution costs would remain. Consequently, carbon capture would weaken the reason for environmentally motivated governments to stop burning fossil fuels in the first place. This is great insofar as it reduces damages from climate change, but it could significantly increase the risk that we keep burning fossil fuels indefinitely, using up the easily accessible resources and undermining the prospects for recovery in the event of civilizational collapse. All in all, my best guess is that we will phase out most fossil fuel burning this century. However, depending on what happens with relevant technological progress, I still think that there's a significant chance that we will continue to burn coal and other fossil fuels for a long time. If so, we would use up a resource that might be crucial for recovery after the collapse of civilization. Conclusion. An all-out nuclear war, perhaps supplemented by bioweapons, would be utterly devastating. Yet the risks from weapons of mass destruction and a potential war between the world's major powers have largely fallen out of the mainstream conversation among those fighting for the better world. I find this both striking and concerning. Although such a catastrophe is, in my view, unlikely to lead to unrecovered civilizational collapse, it is difficult to be extremely confident that it won't. This lingering uncertainty is more than enough to make the risk of unrecovered collapse a key long-termist priority. This risk is exacerbated considerably by our continued burning of fossil fuels. If we fail to wholly decarbonize and burn through the easily accessible fossil fuels, then the odds that we will be able to bounce back from civilizational collapse get much worse. The chance of the end of civilization this century, whether via extinction or permanent collapse, is far too high for us to be comfortable with. In my view, giving this a probability of at least 1% seems reasonable. But even if you think it is only a 1 in 1,000 chance, the risk to humanity this century is still 10 times higher than the risk of your dying this year in a car crash. If humanity is like a teenager, then she is one who speeds around blind corners, drunk, without wearing a seatbelt. And that is just for the risk this century. If we want humanity to survive and flourish over the long term, we need to both make catastrophic risks as small as possible and ensure that they stay small indefinitely. But if society stagnates technologically, it could remain stuck in a period of high catastrophic risk for such a long time that extinction or collapse would be all but inevitable. I turn to this possibility in the next chapter.